It's submitted. Next case on calendar is State versus Worth. Justice Pickering is reclusing on this case. Justice Gibbons wanted to make a representation.
Yes, thank you, Chief. Just for the record, it's my understanding that 100% of the stock of Wyeth was acquired by Pfizer, Inc., who's a party to this action. My wife is a shareholder of Pfizer, Inc., not of Wyeth, but of Pfizer, so she inherited the case, I guess you could say, when Pfizer did the acquisition. So I don't feel it's a disqualifying interest, but I want to disclose it to both parties.
Your Honor, we have no objection.
No objection.
Thank you. Thank you. The parties are ready. Please come forward and make argument. If you wish to reserve any time, please state how much.
Good morning. May it please the Court. My name is Peter Weberall. I'm appearing on behalf of the appellant, State of Nevada. And I'm pleased to be joined this morning by Chief Deputy Attorney General Eric Witkoski of the that office's Bureau of Consumer Protection. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, if I may. We assert that the trial court erred in granting the defendant's motion to dismiss on statute of limitations grounds. In fairness to the trial judge, he did not have the benefit of this court's decision in the ROAP case. Last fall, this court entered its unanimous en banc decision affirming the ROAP plaintiff's $57 million hormone therapy verdict. In the face of Wyeth's denial that its drugs and marketing tactics caused an epidemic of breast cancers, including the ROAP plaintiffs, this court's decision last fall included several rulings which are relevant to this case. For example, in responding to Wyeth's contention that the trial court in ROAT erred in letting the statute of limitations issue go to the jury in that case, this court held, quote, when a claimant discovered or should have discovered the facts constituting a cause of action is a question of fact for the jury, citing Siragusa. Next, in responding to Wyeth's contention that compliance with FDA standards negates its liability for punitive damages, this court held, quote, Wyeth should not be able to benefit from its malicious and deceptive practices. Thereafter, in responding to, strike that, the court further noted, quote, when published medical studies linked estrogen progestin hormone therapy to an increased breast cancer risk, Wyeth sought to downplay the study's results and divert attention from the information. And finally, the court in Wyeth concluded, quote, Wyeth's misrepresentations and concealment of data showed reckless disregard for the health and safety of the users of its drugs. Its conduct involved repeated actions in that the evidence supported many examples of it misrepresenting the risks and benefits of its products. These findings in the Wyeth case beg the question, how can these defendants, who have essentially been caught by this court polluting the science and misrepresenting the true dangers of their drugs, seriously contend that the state of Nevada is time-barred from pursuing a deceptive trade practice action against them?
Counsel, is there any distinction between the deceptive trade practice and then your additional alleging ongoing fraud and false claims?
I'm not sure I understand that.
In terms of your statute of limitation argument, is it the same as the both, or are they slightly different?
The claims are different. Products liability claim pursued on behalf of a woman who has identified having developed a breast cancer in her body and who seeks to seek a remedy for her own specific circumstance, we argue, is a dramatically different circumstance than that presented to an attorney general who is tasked with a very different responsibility of assessing and determining whether or not harm has occurred to the state. Per Rayat and Siragusa, the default rule of law on statute of limitations is that the issue is a question of fact for the jury. this court need not create a new rule nor an exception to the existing rule. It can and should merely enforce the default rule here, which was violated at the defendant's urging in two respects. First, the trial court looked well beyond the four corners of the state's complaint in finding that the statute of limitations had expired on the state's claims. And two, the trial court relied upon circumstances which had no basis in, quote, fact, end quote, with respect to its conclusion that the Nevada Attorney General was somehow duped into pursuing her deceptive trade practice claim by the plaintiff's bar.
And, Mr. Weatherall, did either side request Judge Bixler to take judicial notice of the hormone or replacement therapy litigation or the pleadings or anything?
Yes. The defendants requested that multiple complaints, including a hormone therapy complaint from Philadelphia, which was filed in 2002, as well as hormone therapy complaints filed by my office in 2004. And it's not my contention that the court taking judicial notice of those items was error.
So the court did take judicial notice.
The court did take judicial notice of that. Our contention is that those documents simply aren't sufficient to overcome the default rule that it still remains a jury question. There is nothing about the content of those complaints, which are distinct in very meaningful ways to the state's complaint, that somehow should deprive the state of its day in court to prove what circumstances existed that caused the delay in the filing of its complaint.
So when the judicial notice was taken, I believe you argue, and correct me if I'm wrong, I'm trying to figure out the procedural history here, but you argue that the proper procedure would be the court to consider it under Rule 56 as opposed to Rule 12, and that the pleadings in the other case are fact-based, you know, like then they're beyond the scope of the complaint that you filed.
That's correct, okay. Your Honor. I think the point to be made is if we're going to keep this a Rule 12b-5 motion to dismiss, then let's rest on the four corners of the complaint that's at issue. But if we're not, if we're going to start taking into consideration other matters, then give the state the opportunity to put on a thoroughgoing proffer of what it believes were the circumstances which prevented or otherwise delayed its filing of its complaint to a point in time well beyond the individual litigants filed theirs. If I may, I'd like to turn to the specific questions raised by this court to the parties. First, you queried whether the state's complaint stated or otherwise sufficiently indicated that the state had knowledge of its DTPA action in November 2004 or prior. Our contention is no. The exact opposite is true. The state's complaint disavows sufficient knowledge of its deceptive trade practice action repeatedly. And I'd cite your honors to paragraphs 71 to 74 of that complaint, wherein, in part, those paragraphs state, quote, to this day, defendants have denied that HRT is unreasonably dangerous, that their sales and marketing of said drugs have and continue to occur in a manner which constitutes fraud or false claims, or that their sales and marketing of their drugs involve fraudulent misrepresentations regarding their drugs' safety and efficacy, end quote. The complaint goes on to state, plaintiff has been misled and denied access to vital information essential to the pursuit of these claims. Paragraph 73 refers to defendant's, quote, active concealment, end quote, of the true character, quality, and nature of HRT. And paragraph 74 says, quote, up to the present, defendants willfully deceived Nevada physicians and consumers by concealing the true facts concerning HRT, which the defendants had a duty to disclose. All but one of those paragraphs was not set forth in any of the 2004 complaints. The defense wants to contend that that's boilerplate language. It's actually language that was purposely put into the state's complaint precisely because we recognized that time had elapsed between the individual parties' complaints and the state's complaints, and we anticipated a battle or litigation on the issue of whether or not that was reasonable. So clearly more than boilerplate language. But by those allegations, I think it's clear that the state was disavowing that it had the ability to pursue its cause of action sooner than it did. You next queried whether judicial notice of the 2004 allegations to prove inquiry notice would have been appropriate when the plaintiff and cause of action were different. Our answer is no. A private litigant's knowledge or inquiry of their claims cannot be imputed to the state because both the harms and the causes of actions of these litigants are distinct. For example, an individual litigant who developed breast cancer sometime before the filing of her complaint before 2004 is simply situated differently than the Attorney General of Nevada, who is not operating from the development of breast cancer and an effort to figure out what may have caused that.
Mr. Weatherall, I think in your reply brief you indicated that the Attorney General had not received complaints from consumers over this time period, therefore your argument is the statute of limitations is told. Would you tell me the legal basis for that?
Well, and this goes into the third query of the court, whether there was anything that the state could have produced that would have demonstrated that inquiry notice was not conclusive based on the factual allegations in the 2004 complaints. As an aside, I think it's important that the trial court struggled with matters outside the pleadings as well, and now you're interested in finding out circumstances outside the pleadings, which again suggests that this is a fact-specific, plaintiff-specific inquiry that should have been allowed to proceed to a jury, or at least to the summary judgment phase, versus merely based on the four corners of the complaint. But getting back to your question, I attempted to make an oral proffer at the hearing on the motion, and I laid out a litany of circumstances, not the least of which was that the Attorney General's office had not received any complaints from individual citizens, which would have triggered in the mind of the Attorney General or that office a need to go forward and investigate a circumstance. If the situation had been, for example, that my office mailed off copies of the 2004 complaints to the Attorney General's office and said, hey, we filed these lawsuits, you should take a look at this, it might be a different issue. And in terms of the reasonableness of being unaware of the ability to pursue litigation. But here we have, number one, the allegation of ongoing fraud and deceit going past the date of the 2004 complaint filing. We have the investigation by Senator Grassley, which was initiated on the issue of ghostwriting and the effect that that had on the pollution of the science on breast cancer. That investigation was initiated in December of 2008, 1 month after our Attorney General's complaint was filed. And on page 2 of that report, it indicates that the investigation into Wyeth's ghostwriting practices was triggered precisely by the results and the freeing up of information in hormone therapy litigation. At that time, there were three cases, including the Roark case, which freed up the documents for review. And the conclusion of that investigative report wasn't done until June of 2010.
So you're at 3:15 at this point.
I'll stop unless the court has any questions and save it for rebuttal. Thank you.
Good morning, Chief Justice Douglas. May it please the court. Dan Pulsenberg for respondents. This complaint sets out everything one needs to conclude that the causes of action that the Attorney General is bringing here all involved acts that were discovered before 2004. Now, there are 51 factual allegations in this complaint. They go from paragraph 9 to 59. And they set out that in the 1960s, the 1970s, 80s, 90s, up until the year 2000, the respondents allegedly engaged in misrepresentations regarding the long-term use of these drugs and the hormone replacement therapy. They also allege that a number of studies, the Women's Health Initiative, the abrupt stop of the EMP arm of the EMP of the WHI, the articles that were published, the WHI report, the Journal of American Medical Association, New England Journal of Medicine, and they say numerous other studies published. And that's all in 2002. And then they set out that these respondents in paragraph 55 and 56, and twice in 55, say abandoned. These respondents abandoned those practices. And this was all public, and this was all objectively knowable before 2004. Now, they bring up the Rowat decision, and they say in the footnote of the Rowat decision, Justice Cherry mentions that it's a question of fact. Well, let's remember, the Rowat decision is different from this case in the sense that it's the same in involving all pre-2002 activities. All there is in that one footnote is saying that when the statute of limitations arises, it is often a question of fact. Those complaints were filed. All three complaints in the Rowat case were filed in July 2004. The issues in those cases, whether there was something before 2002 that would have put the plaintiffs in those cases on inquiry notice. Here, the complaint sets out all the acts that are involved. All those acts took place before 2004.
As allegations of ongoing, how do you deal with those?
The allegations of ongoing conduct aren't really allegations of ongoing conduct. Remember, all the factual allegations are 50 to 59. It stops in 2003. And as counsel now admits, they added new paragraphs different from the private right of action complaints, starting at paragraph 71. These are not factual allegations. These are claims for fraud. These come after the Deceptive Trade Practices Act. And what they are saying is that the statute of limitation is told by knowing concealment, and there is no knowing concealment. There is no concealment here that concealed the facts that were made public in 2003 and the abandonment by these respondents in 2003. In January, the Dear Doctor letter, the full-page advertisements in 180 newspapers across the country. There is no concealment that they allege that takes place after. There is no specific action that's going on after 2003. All they say is, and the one spot where they use to this day, is the second sentence of paragraph 71. After they claim that there's a denial of facts, which would serve to be a concealment, they say that we have denied that HRT is unreasonably dangerous, denied that sales and marketing were based on fraud and continued things of fraud, and denied that their sales and marketing involved fraudulent misrepresentations. They're not saying that there were things that happened after 2003. They're just saying that we are denying that this is unreasonably unsafe. The denials, yes, that we made in Rowat, but the facts here on which they base their claims are the same facts that the individual or private right of action plaintiffs based their claims in 2004 that they admit in the district court. Counsel admitted that there was basis to understand and allege in 2004 that there was a deception. The same basis that the Attorney General, on which the Attorney General brings this action, is what is the basis, the publicly known facts in 2004. These facts were known before November 2004. The individual plaintiffs all brought their actions in July. The Attorney General waited till November. On the four corners of the complaint, it is clear that this action is based on an alleged program, an alleged marketing strategy for long-term use of hormone replacement therapy that was discovered to be inaccurate and a misrepresentation in 2002, and which these defendants all abandoned in 2003. From the face of the complaint, you can draw that. Their concession makes that clear, and Judge Bixler is saying that that's what he based his decision on. Now they're coming in and they're making other arguments. They're saying that, well, the Attorney General is in a different position, that somehow the Attorney General needs to discover more things. Fraud is fraud. If the fraud was discovered in 2002 and 2003, it is discovered for the Attorney General as well. And in fact, the Attorney General has less to discover. While the private right of action plaintiffs have to discover an individual harm to them, the Attorney General simply has to discover deceptive acts. And from the face of their complaint, it is clear that that was objectively knowable before 2004. Now, they come in and they say that there are some procedural irregularities. I think this is all a great distraction. We did attach to our motion to dismiss similar complaints. They didn't object to that. They pointed out in page 3 of their opposition, they say there is nothing beyond the complaint involved here. That we're not going, the district court isn't going beyond its pleadings. They made that same statement in the beginning of their oral argument in the district court on January 25th. It is clear that here that is an appropriate use of judicial notice. And in fact, even now at the lectern, plaintiff's counsel is saying, we don't object to the fact that there was judicial notice taken of these complaints. There isn't anything objectionable about them. Nobody is claiming that they are inaccurate. Nobody is claiming that there is a dispute in the facts. The allegations in those complaints are the same as the allegations in these complaints. And it is the fact that they were filed that is the most imperative factor here. And they don't deny the fact. In fact, they concede the fact that those complaints in 2004 make clear that there was a basis to understand and allege the fraud involved here. One of the justices asked a question about citizen complaints, and that they are coming in here, and at the end they've made these representations, well, there were no citizen complaints involved. Let's look at the role of the Attorney General when a Deceptive Trade Practices Act is involved. In the same reply brief in which they make the point that there were no citizen complaints, they also cite the State X. Rel. Brady case from Delaware. And that's a case that says if the Attorney General is going to take a passive attitude and just sit there and wait for cases to come to him or her, the Attorney General is in the position that it is, that the time is running, even if the Attorney General isn't doing anything. But really, the state has a much better situation than any, far from having a longer statute of limitations, the Attorney General has available to it incredible resources. We know they have consumer affairs divisions. We know that under the Deceptive Trade Practices Act itself, NRS Chapter 598, particularly at Section 096, once it has reason to believe that there might be a deceptive trade practice involved by any person in any deceptive trade practice, so it doesn't require a large scheme to put them on inquiry notice, the Attorney General has the ability to go out and conduct information, conduct investigation, can request documents from us, can go to doctors. There's a great deal that the Attorney General can do. Now, they say they made an oral proffer on what it is that they could have presented. But really, their oral proffer is not much at all. And what they seem to be saying is, and they seem to concede inquiry notice, they seem to concede that the Attorney General knew, or there were objectively knowable facts that the Attorney General should have known and been on inquiry notice. And instead, what they argue, I submit, is there were factors the Attorney General had to consider. Even now, counsel said, what caused the Attorney General to delay in filing the claim? That goes to the inquiry in inquiry notice. Inquiry notice, since Massey versus Litton, has been clear that once there's enough that you know or should know that you could have a claim, you have a duty of due diligence to investigate the claim. Well, the Attorney General is coming in now saying, well, there are a lot of factors that the Attorney General or her three predecessors in office since 2002 needed to consider in deciding whether to bring a claim. And but those factors, first of all, that doesn't go to the objective standard of whether you're on notice. And secondly, that goes to the decision that is being made. If an Attorney General is on inquiry notice and decides not to go forward, that claim is waived. And there can't be this analysis that there has to be all sorts of factors that they consider. Let me also address the four questions that Mr. Weatherall has addressed, and I think I can do that in summary fashion. Number one, the court asked whether the state's complaint stated or otherwise sufficiently indicated it had knowledge of the Deceptive Trade Practice action in November 2004, 4 years before the complaint, or prior. Yes. As I have made clear, the factual allegations in paragraphs from 9 to 59 make clear that the Attorney General is bringing an action based on representations made before 2004 about the long-term use. Now, Mr. Chief Justice, if they're claiming now that we are saying that those are not harmful misrepresentations or that we're denying that there was anything wrong with those, that still doesn't go to the fact that they knew in 2002 about all these studies. And they knew and alleged that in 2003 we abandoned these practices. These are not ongoing activities. These are not ongoing fraud that they've alleged in paragraph 71 through 74. Question two, whether judicial notice of the 2004 allegations to prove inquiry notice would have been appropriate when the plaintiff and the cause of action were different. Let me break that into two. Judicial notice. There's nothing inappropriate, and there was no objection to the judicial notice of the prior complaints. There's no denial about them. There's no claim that they were inaccurate. They're in highly related cases. In fact, all cases that were consolidated in front of Judge Bixler, they were so related. We set that out in our respondent's appendix, and on page one of the appellant's appendix, you can see that. It says right on their complaint that it's consolidated with the other actions. So judicial notice is not inappropriate. But the question also asks whether the plaintiffs have different causes of action. Again, I stress, fraud is fraud. There weren't different causes of action. The underlying private litigants were bringing causes of action based on the same misrepresentations. Now, they had to prove, and I stress again, they had to prove more by proving harm to themselves, and perhaps they had to be on inquiry notice of that harm. But the state's cause of action requires only a deception. And the Attorney General was on notice of that. Question three, whether there was anything that the state could have produced. Judge Bixler said no, there's nothing the state could have produced that would have made a difference in his analysis that the statute of limitations barred this complaint from the four corners of the document itself. And they repeatedly said, you know, under 12b-5, they have every opportunity in the world to present their own evidence. They could have done it in their opposition to the motion to dismiss. They could have done it at the hearing. They filed a supplemental cert rebuttal, which even I think is an unusual procedure. And they didn't set out what the evidence was. Even today, they don't actually make a proffer to show what it is. And they make allusions to documents, and those allusions are just to things that had to do not with the Attorney General not being on inquiry notice, but with the Attorney General making the decision not to file. 14 seconds, the last question. Whether the allegations of ongoing fraud, Mr. Chief Justice, that is your question you asked both of us. They're not alleging ongoing fraud. They're not alleging that there are other fraudulent acts or deceptive practices these respondents have engaged in. They are simply alleging that we have denied unreasonable dangerous.
Well, Mr. Posenberg, on that point, what if one were to view the complaint as including claims post-2003 for the go-low with PEMPRO advertising and that was a misrepresentation for claims that occurred after 2003.
They don't allege that that is so. What they, in fact, do is say that our promotion of lower dose and lower duration was abandonment of our prior activities. They're not alleging that that was a misrepresentation. If they were to say somehow that that were, they could file another complaint right now, which would be a different document, which would have different allegations in it. And
well, I guess for me, at least, this raises the concern about consideration of matters outside the pleadings, at least as to that part of the claims, because it would affect the standard under which the court should have examined that claim. Your argument is that they never made the claim that misrepresentation was based upon the 2003 advertising.
Everything in the complaint had to do with the promotion of hormone replacement therapy before 2003. Mm-hmm. And everything then was knowable before 2004. They are not alleging, it is a very precise complaint. It is actually a beautiful piece of writing. If you look at paragraphs 9 to 59, they are alleging that our deceptive trade practice was promoting long-term, higher-dose use of hormone replacement therapy.
Your argument would be that the complaint doesn't even allege misrepresentations for low-dose usage of HRT.
It does not. It comes nowhere near doing that. If that were their claim, they would have filed another complaint. And theoretically, they could file another complaint, but they would have to make completely different allegations. I would respectfully submit, although this is no place to argue that, that they wouldn't be able to do that, that that would be a different complaint, different causes of action, different facts involved, and we'd be dealing with an entirely different situation. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Mr. Polzenberg's comments notwithstanding, the rule under 12b-5 isn't what Mr. Polzenberg's interpretation of the complaint is. The complaint is supposed to be viewed in a light most favorable to the plaintiff. And that is
on that score. If you wouldn't mind, Mr. Weatherall, could you identify a point in the complaint in which you are seeking damages on behalf of the state for the lowest effective dose short-term use of PEMPRO?
Well, the complaint is intending to encompass far more allegations than that, Your Honor.
Well, could you just give me an example?
Paragraphs 71 to 74 I've already indicated. That's all we've got, but it's very broadly worded to encompass misrepresentations made by sales representatives in the context of interactions with doctors about whether or not they should still be prescribing this drug and under what circumstances and things of that sort. Disavowments of the risks of taking these drugs that occurred long after 2004. Things of that sort. That's why the specific language that was injected into this state's complaint is broad enough to encompass all of
it. Did one of your pro-offers include to Judge Bixler your concern that the complaint sought damages for use of low-dosage short-term HRT and that he should consider responsive pleadings from you and affidavits on that subject?
Was your question, did we request that in the trial?
In your pro-offer that you referenced earlier, did you include in the pro-offer your concerns about the dismissal of portions of the complaint that dealt with the use of low-dose and short-term HRT?
No, because what I understood the trial court to be requesting was information of a proffer to the extent that what facts are we aware of that would come out in the motion for summary judgment that may make a difference to the judge. So that issue never came up. With respect to the couple of points here made by Mr. Polzenberg, in the X. Rel. Brady case, I think the distinguishing factors there are that actual complaints occurred to the AG's office in that circumstance, and more importantly, the conduct at issue in X. Rel. Brady was undisputedly not occurring for the last 5 years. So in this circumstance, our Attorney General has actually sought injunctive relief to prevent further misrepresentations and deceit, which, again, would not have been requested or alleged were it not very clear that this was this is conduct that, at least as of the filing of the complaint, is alleged to be ongoing. If the Court has no further questions.
Any additional questions?
Thank you.
Thank you. The Court appreciates the arguments offered this morning with clarity and answer questions submitted by this Court. This matter stands submitted. We stand in recess till 11:30.
All right. Or is it recess?